Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality, and is about discovering your place in this great universe, from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life, and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here this evening. Tonight, we are going to be talking about what happens when your soul journey collides with the journey in which you thought you were playing out. You had this game plan, this life plan, and you said, I am following it all along. Things are happening. I'm right on course. All of a sudden, your soul says, I think there's something else out there. What else is there out there? Where have we been before? Where are we going? I would like you to shift into something else. Are you ready? Today, my guest is Dr. Erica Elliott. Her book is Medicine and Miracles in the High Desert, My Life Among the Navajo People. Dr. Elliott has definitely come to a place where her soul says, wake up, because it's time, and to see how the pieces of the puzzles of her life have fit together to be able to play out a soul journey. Dr. Erica, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Dr. Jeanette.
Oh, I was so glad to have you. So, Dr. Erica, don't you think that we say, I've got it all planned out and this is what I'm supposed to do, right?
Right. And sometimes that's not the way it is.
Yeah. I think it's kind of cool in a way when we get to that point where we say, uh-oh, what's next? But as we all know, I'm in my 60s, that if we grew up in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s, it was taboo to have anything of a kind of creative mind. You really had to fit into this path, don't you think?
Yeah, you did. And that's why some of my experiences, I didn't talk about them because they didn't fit the times I lived in. They were sort of from another reality. And so, but now I felt it was time to tell the story because I think people are more open-minded and can let in experiences that are very foreign to them.
Absolutely. You know, so many times in my life, and I'm sure you as well, somewhere in your, I guess we'd say our mind's eye or our thoughts or whatever you want to call it, we've heard, you're ahead of your time. You're ahead of your time. It's okay. And sit down and rest. Because we had to wait until the others kind of caught up to some sense of being able to understand, almost as if the breeze of the wind, you kind of had to know that you felt something. In other words, we couldn't have these concepts or thoughts that you talk about in your book and see how the puzzle pieces fit together if we hadn't cleared away some of the old first, don't you think?
Yes, I agree.
Can you share a little bit, Dr. Erica, how your life started? Because I think many times people will say, oh, was that the time of the hippies when everybody was doing these rebel things, you know? And we look back and we say, oh, no, it was just something that I went out and I decided to do. Do you think that maybe some of the things you did in your early life were right along with how others might have been feeling then?
Yeah, I think people, when they talked to me, when I said I was going to go out into the middle of nowhere and teach fourth grade on a Navajo reservation in a very remote area, they acted as though I'd lost my mind. But I think part of them wished that they were adventurous too and willing to leave their old program life behind and just start with a clean slate and go out there. And, people have confessed to me throughout my life that they wish they could have had the nerve to do what I did. I didn't regard it as nerve. I regarded it as I had a very strong sense that I had a purpose in life and I needed to find that purpose. And I didn't know what that purpose was, but I knew I had one, and I knew I would go across the world trying to find what I was supposed to do in this life.
Right, and I think what that really is about the time of setting your feet on the path of the seeker. And as we set our feet on that path, it's almost as if we're not given rocks and we're told to be able to create the path in a certain way. It's almost as if it's like looking out at the cosmos and we say, oh my gosh, it's exploration, it's creativity, it's something unique and different. Don't you think it's a different type of path?
Oh, it's a different type of path. I didn't really know what my path was, and so I was feeling
right.
around blindly based on instinct. And each time I took a turn on the path, I'd say, oh, that feels right, or no, that doesn't feel quite right. And then I'd feel my way through and getting closer and closer to finding what I was supposed to be doing with my life.
You know, it's interesting when you said about being able to go to the reservation to teach children, and instantly you wanted to be able to leave. And I think right there you said, ooh, okay, I need to put my feet firmly on the ground. And maybe the ground spoke to you. Maybe the ancient people did. Maybe something in your soul did, or maybe something in your past life. Don't you think if we just open ourselves up and listen or hear, even if we don't know what it means, to be able to say, I get it, okay, I don't know what it is or what you're saying, but I think I'll just take this in. Don't you think that's what really set you on the path?
Well, my father said something that sort of, quote, saved me. I was really ready to go home. I thought, I don't belong here.
Right.
This is my place. These people are so strange. Their land is so strange. I can't identify with any of it. So I called my father after a week, and I said, I'm coming home. I made a big mistake. Everybody was right. This is crazy doing this. I don't know why I ever thought about doing this. And he said, you mustn't come home. You've only been there a week. You cannot judge a person, place, culture, or land from only being there a week.
Wow.
Why don't you stay there 3 months, and then if you're unhappy, then come back and find a job someplace else. But coming home after a week, you haven't given the place a chance. And right after he said that, well, I agreed I would wait 3 months, but I thought it's going to be an awful 3 months. Right after that, the teacher aide, Donna Scott, who's Navajo and versed in Anglo world as well as traditional Navajo, she said to me, which was life-changing, she said, do you want to learn about my people? And that
okay.
the road to this magical world unfolded. The more Navajo language I learned, the more deeply welcomed into the culture I was. It completely changed my life. And I just think, oh, my God, if I had left and gone home, I would have missed my life calling. I would have
okay.
missed out on this huge transformational time in my life.
Because also, too, when you go to teach them, you believe that you had the clues or the answers. When you went there, they were going to teach you something different. They were going to teach you about the inner world, the heart, the soul, the earth. And that is a different lesson to be able to teach you. So just then, the teacher became the student as well as the students became the teachers, yes?
Yeah, we had a beautiful exchange. They would teach me Navajo and about their way of life. They'd invite me into their remote homes and ceremonies. And in return, I would teach them English. And they learned English so fast. They reached the fourth grade without speaking English, which is kind of like, huh? Well, that was because
right.
they had no relationship with their teachers or their books. Their books they couldn't relate to at all, Dick and Jane. And so when they saw how much I cared about them and was trying to learn their language, they in turn wanted to share with me their world. So they were on fire learning English. They learned so fast that by the end of the year, I entered them into a speech contest, and three of them won blue ribbons. This is unheard of. It was something so transformative, the exchange of love created this huge, magical situation where the impossible became possible. Like, how can you go from not speaking English and by the end of the year you win a blue ribbon? It's because
right.
they wanted desperately for me to know about them and their lives and their sheep and their hogans and their family and their medicine men and so forth. So they were terribly motivated to learn English. And I was terribly motivated to learn about their life. So it was a beautiful exchange of love.
But don't you think in a way also too, Dr. Erica, that was about learning about humans and our life force and about that we're all equal on this world? In other words, you kind of maybe didn't see as much, or over time it diminished, the differences between different peoples.
That's so true. I went so deep into their culture, and I felt so much love for them that I totally forgot that I was white. And sometimes I'd have jarring experiences that woke me up. Oh, I'm white. I'm different. But when I wasn't aware of that, I felt like I was totally, there was no difference between me and the Navajo people that I was with.
Do you think that in a way the Navajo people, they have a culture or a sense of the earth so much, and I look at us and as a separation just for this moment, and I'll say maybe we are more concerned with being able to have house and kids and jobs and all this other stuff. And if we look at it, we say how these both lives are in parallel and existing at the same time. So really on the earth, there are many parallel lifetimes. It's just whether or not we choose to step over the line to be able to live in that space, yes?
Yes, exactly.
You know, and also too, your book, again, the book is Medicine and Miracles in the High Desert. Truly your book is a story of those parallel lives as it unfolds, because you could see how you may have been somewhere in a knowing of being able to be there. In other words, you didn't go running and screaming after the 3 months. You kind of were really immersed in it. So something in you must have turned, yes?
Well, as soon as I started speaking Navajo, all the children looked up at me for the first time and made eye contact, and they were no longer shy with me and mute. And
right.
And that's when the love affair began, when I reached out. Instead of me teaching them Dick and Jane and forcing them to do things that were foreign to them, I reached out, I reached into their world, and that was the beginning of falling madly in love with those children.
Yeah, it really gives you a deeper meaning, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah. I bridged the divide. I reached out. They had never heard a white person speak Navajo, and so they were just blown away.
Do you think that in a way, in other words, did you have difficulty being able to immerse in it, or did it feel as if it was, we always say there's a sense as if it's a knowing already, and it came very easy. In other words, as if your feet had already been on this path or been in this earth at that time.
It felt like so much like I had been there before. In fact, my Navajo friends used to kid me and say, you're a white Navajo woman. That's what you are. And they gave me a name. It's Asantachi, which means Navajo woman with red skin. And that's, they called me red skin because I was always sunburned on my cheeks. And, I learned the language. You know, the language is the hardest language in the world. It was the only code in World War II that was never broken, and it wasn't a code. It was just their language is impossible. And yet I learned it. So it was like something was familiar. It felt familiar. The ceremonies felt familiar. And these were very foreign to anything I had ever really experienced in this life, but somehow it felt like I must have had another life where I was indeed a Navajo woman, because I'm learning these things so fast, and
right.
I feel so comfortable that something's going on.
And also, too, the Navajo people really welcomed you into their culture. Can you share a little bit about the medicine man, but also, too, the idea of when you talk about the spirit guide? Because many times people will say, oh, I have a spirit guide. I know what it is. And it's very, they're just now dabbling into the word and the feeling of that.
Well, the spirit guide, how that happened, I was camping by myself. I was so enamored with being in nature that I wasn't scared or anything, because I just felt so at home. I went deep into very wild country in Utah to camp far away from any roads or anything, and it was just gorgeous. And I laid my pad on a rock, and it was a full moon, and got in my sleeping bag, and in the middle of the night, I dreamt that I was rounding up billy goats that were really stinky, had a strong musk smell that the males have, and it was so strong that it felt like a real life. And then I realized it was real life. I was smelling something, and I was awake. My eyes were still closed, but I heard a sniffing sound. I opened my eyes, and a mountain lion was maybe 2 or 3 inches from my face, sniffing me. I could, in the moonlight, see his whiskers and his tawny snout, and I was scared to death. I was so scared that I didn't move, and that's what saved me. On one level, of looking at it, because they like things that move. So when I, in the morning, when I stuffed my sleeping bag, I could still smell the musk. It was a male mountain lion, and that was his pheromones that smelled so strongly. And when I went back to the school and talked to the teacher aides and all Navajo teacher aides, one of them took me back into Canyon de Chelly to visit her grandmother, who's ancient, and told the story to the grandmother, all in Navajo. The grandmother didn't speak English. And the grandmother said that the mountain lion was my spirit guide, and he had come to offer me his strength and intense focus and courage, because she said I would need that in my life, that I would face many life-threatening challenges, and it wasn't clear if I would survive them, but if I did survive them, I would have a strong heart and powerful medicine to bring to the people. And that was before I became a medical doctor. This was like 50 years ago when I was a school teacher. And all her prophecy completely came true. I mean, I had 2 life-threatening challenges that almost did me in, and it made me be a much better doctor.
Yeah, and I think what you said, too, is that when you faced the spirit animal, is when you face that shows in front of you, right then and there, you just have the experience, and all you're doing is taking in the energy. That's it. It's just about immersing in the moment, closing your eyes, and just being with it. And then it becomes a part of you. So when you had that experience and it became part of you, you knew you could draw upon that same experience again by calling forth the image of the spirit animal. But really what you're doing is you're conjuring up all of the cells of your body that have already known that experience, don't you think?
Yes, that's well said. Yes, exactly.
Let's talk for a second about when you went back and you were a physician to be able to help them. You know, I think it's so vitally important because even as you wrote your story, you know, right at the first day when you said you were the new doctor and they were waiting for you, and isn't that interesting when they say they're waiting for you? In other words, they knew you were coming anyway. You know, they knew in some sense, in some way, you were coming back. But when you had to help the medicine man as your first patient and he passed away, I really, when I was reading the book, I said, oh, he passed the torch. He passed the torch to you. Yeah. And then your next patient was a birth. And that showed the birth of your life going forward in his position. Isn't that something when we look at symbolism and how our life plays out?
Profound symbolism. Yeah, exactly. And she had one of them had a difficult birth. She had seizures, and one of them had an easy birth. And I think 3 different births that night, if my memory is correct. And I think all that's symbolic too.
Yeah, it is, because when seizures, when we think about the spiritual journey, that's when the soul is trying to decide: do I come in or do I not? is this safe for me to be here? Is it not? Or the mother, do I decide, is my soul going to vacate or not? And that's really very much a symbol too. So maybe in a way you were thinking, do I keep going? I'll be okay. And they're saying yes, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And then I thought it was symbolic too when the Navajo relatives, they didn't know I live with the Navajos. These are a different group of Navajo people in a different part of the, in a different state. And it was in New Mexico. And they didn't know this new doctor spoke Navajo and stuff. And they were complaining that this new doctor, meaning me, could not bring back to life their dead relatives. Well, he arrived, DOA, dead on arrival, when he got to my clinic, and most doctors would have said, oh, he's dead. Okay, we'll make, you know, arrangements. But I tried to resuscitate a dead man. And but anyway, when we finally called it off and I had to face the room full of angry relatives, a whole room full with their arms crossed and everything, and I had tears in my eyes, and I was saying, so sorry that you lost your relative. And then I started speaking Navajo, and everything changed. The arms stopped being crossed. There was little smiles on the face. And after I finished talking, they lined up to shake my hand. And then it was totally different experience. They were all really kind to me. They'd bring me gifts. They'd bring me food to the clinic. They'd bring me little weavings and jewelry and stuff like that. It was just, they saw that I really cared, and that made a huge difference in how they viewed me.
Right. And I think also too, they can almost sense that maybe the medicine man's energy had come through in you, you know, in your words, because you definitely can feel that. You know, we all know this in medicine, is that we feel, whether we say it or not, you know, that transference, or you feel that sense of energy when someone passes on.
Yeah.
It goes through your hands when you're still trying, as you said, to revive someone that already passed on. You knew in some sense, and you could feel it, and in your bones somewhere, something shifted. Don't you think that maybe they also sensed that?
Yeah, because they were extremely nice to me. They were so kind, so respectful to me. I think they sensed something like that, because they treated me completely different than the other practitioners that they dealt with.
Right. I think it's all, they could almost like sense it. You know, like sometimes they say, you know how people will say, oh, the grandfather died, and now you see it in the child that's born. It's almost as if it shows up, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, and they'd always ask for me when they wanted their babies delivered and stuff like that. It was very touching, very touching.
Let's talk for a second about the position of grandmothers and elders and what they have in the Navajo. You know, I look at myself, you know, in the 60s now, and we say, people, you know, that I speak to will say, well, nobody really wants to talk to me. Nobody wants to hear what I have to say. Nobody's interested in being around with me. Don't you think sometimes our culture has disavowed the elders of our community and truly cast them off for new things, fast, pretty, perfect, and they're really missing out on being able to know the sense of the cycle of life?
Oh, they're missing out in a huge way. I mean, in the among traditional Navajos, and I imagine this applies to most tribes that are traditional and still follow their traditions, the elders are revered. In fact, when you have a problem and you can't solve it, that's where you go, to the elders. And they get together, and they, and if that elder can't solve it, they get together with other elders, and they have a council to solve your problem. It's incredible. They're so embraced by these elders who keep you on the right path. It's very moving.
Yeah, I think it's so revered and it's so honored. And I think until your waning days, they're still by your side. In other words, the sense of community or the sense of caretaking. We see it in healthcare now. You know, everybody's saying, well, how many palliative care places can we put up and how many assisted living houses, you know, can we put on the corner now instead of apartments? And it's sort of, you know, families have left their loved ones, and physicians are kind of like pushing this too. Oh, well, you can't take care of them. Let's just put them here. Don't you think that's a disservice?
Oh, that was so shocking to me when I left the reservation, and also when I left the Peace Corps in the Andes. When I came back to the United States, it took me a year to adjust coming back to my own country, because it felt so foreign to me in a not a good way. It felt like so disconnected that it was incredibly materialistic. I mean, when you get people get used to it. I get used to it after a while, but that first year coming back was terribly disturbing to me. I thought, geez, do I belong in this country? You know, they put people away. You know, if you have an impairment, you go to some facility. If you're old, you go to a facility. If you're chronically ill, you go to a facility. It seemed like such an alienated culture, and people were ensconced in their beautiful, huge homes, rattling around in these giant homes. It just seemed not conducive to human growth and thriving. It seemed like a culture that creates disease.
Right, and it also was a vested business. Because there's always a business that will say you need life insurance, you know, you need a physician, you need a priest, you need your drug dealer, your pharmacy or whatever, and you need these other people that will know when you're not, quote, acting correctly and put you in alignment. And I think really, truly, what you probably experienced with the Navajo people is about all of these things, about all of the ups and downs of the human existence. But don't you think also you learned about the process of the heart and empathy and how to care no matter what, for everyone?
Yes, and something that really stuck out for me that was so in contrast to white society is the traditional Navajos don't try to stick out. They don't try to be the smartest or the most beautiful or the wealthiest. They are community-based. They don't want to go ahead of the pack because they want to stick together. They're in it together. And that struck me as like, wow, this is so different from white culture. White culture, right. People want to stick out. Look at me. I'm so important. And I'm so rich. And I'm so tall. And I'm so beautiful. And I'm so thin. And I'm so this. And I'm so that. And that's so, so not in Navajo culture, at least traditional Navajo culture. That's so foreign.
It's because already they're connected with their soul. I think their soul is their identity versus their human existence, which comes from the outside. You know, just as we share, you know, when you want to stick out, it's sort of like someone else needs to validate me so I know I'm here and I'm welcome. Right. Whereas in Navajo culture, you know, everyone is welcome irregardless. You could close your eyes and everybody is the same, you know, whereas our human existence here, you know, in the U.S., we're saying, well, I have to see you to know if I want to be around you or not. I have to sniff you and smell you, you know, and I have to touch you and feel you and poke you, and I'll decide if you're welcome in my circle, you know, and that's devaluation. So I think really, don't you think that the Navajo people really know the value of soul, of life that they've been given?
Oh, yeah. They're so connected to things that are important. So connected.
Let's talk for a second about the power of herbal medicine, of knowing the land, of being able to eat, drink, and be able to sustain yourself. Isn't that truly what they do too?
The traditional elders do that. The young people are not keeping up. There are some young people who are keeping up with that, but mostly it's the elders who still know about the herbs, and they're so knowledgeable. My God, the grandmother I live with and herded sheep with, I was incredulous at her knowledge of herbs and which one does what, and this one for blindness for the goats, and this one for dyeing for the red color and the ochre color for her weavings, and this one for a cough. It was, wow, I couldn't keep up with. There was so much to learn, and, you know, it looks like, oh, it's the desert out there. Wow, it sure comes to life walking around with grandmother.
Absolutely, because I can remember when I was in Arizona, and it was always the concept they would say, well, you need to bring your drugs to us or your herbs to us. And I would say, no, when we come, we will find the herbs around you that are there to sustain you. And I think they really know this, that which is growing around you is meant to keep you well and nourished and cared for when something shows up, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's so moving the way when living with the grandparents, the way they use everything around them,
right. And
you think, oh, these people have nothing, but they have everything. It's amazing. I learned so much by living with these people in the middle of nowhere and herding their sheep and goats, and I was in awe, and I said to myself, make a mental note. Look how. I'm talking to myself. Look how little you need to be happy. I kept saying that to myself.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really need much of anything. Look how these people, they have everything they need. And yet you look at their place and you think, geez, they're so poor. They don't regard themselves as poor at all. These grandparents, they regard themselves as rather wealthy. But most white people would say, oh, they're totally destitute and they live in terrible poverty. They had everything they needed. And fortunately, they didn't have a TV, so they didn't see what other people have.
Right. And I think that was the idea, you know, when the internet came along, that everybody said, you know, they were kept in a certain space with the books in the library down the street. Internet came along and all of a sudden it says there's so much more out there, and now people are opening up to it. I think also, too, don't you think, Dr. Erica, that your story is really about a full cycle circle of something of a path that you've already walked before in some lifetime? Maybe you completed it, maybe you didn't, but it was also about showing you all the steps now in clear color.
That you really grasp my book in a way that most people don't. They sense that there's a deeper story. They sense it, but they don't have the words for it like you do.
Oh, well, you know, I think, Dr. Erica, it's just when you're able to sit with it and hold it, do you know what I mean? In other words, just take it and know the language, and as I guess that's probably it. I guess I probably know the language, and I can understand and feel the undercurrent, and I can notice the force in your book. Your book is not just words on a page about your story. Your book has a vital force of its own. It has a golden thread in which it shows how it was weaving, and I think that's truly what it. When you're able to start feeling that, you'll feel this in other people, and then that's how we pass it on. Yes.
That's beautiful, the way you worded that. That's so beautiful. Thank you.
You're so welcome. I think also, too, you're able to now pass it on to others with your book. And again, your book is Medicine and Miracles in the High Desert. Aren't you able to share that now with other physicians or other people so they could say, I don't know, but we're saying, I don't know either, but isn't this a great story? And it'll turn something in them?
Yes, so many people that I don't know who they are, strangers, have written me, and they don't speak as clearly as you, but they say, this book profoundly moved me, but they can't really say how, like you
right.
do. And but they say something happened to them reading it. And so I think what happened is what you're describing.
Yeah, it's about being able to feel it and to be open, and I think that's where we're all at. Well, Dr. Erica, it was a pleasure to speak with you. Can you share with the listeners how to find out more information about your work?
Sure. I have my professional website is www.ericaelliottmd.com. That's ericaelliottmd.com. And unfortunately, I'm not able to take new patients because people read the website. website and they say, oh, she can handle what I have. I'm going to call her up. But so I have 1,200 patients. I can't possibly take on more, sadly. But you might find that website useful. But what you really might find useful is my blog site. It's www.musings, with an S, Musings, Memoir, and Medicine, and it's A-N-D, musingsmemoirandmedicine.com. And if you're interested more in the medical part, it's divided into categories. You click under medicine and only the medical posts will appear, and I write about things that most doctors don't know anything about. And then there's memoir and there's travel, there's recipes that are really helpful. And then if you want to buy the book, you can get it at Amazon.com. And if you enjoy the book, if you feel like writing a review, that'd be really nice.
Well, very good. Well, Dr. Erica, it was such a pleasure to speak with you today, because once we get into the flow of being able to understand, feel, and sense others, we really want to have a great conversation. That's what we did today. So we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I loved talking with you, Dr. Jeanette.
Oh, I'm so happy. I think, you know, when we're able to talk, we're able to hear, and others will be able to pick up something, and that's just how we create it, yes?
Yeah, it's great to be on the same page with you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
If you'd like to find out more information about Dr. Erica Elliott, again, her book is Medicine and Miracles in the High Desert, My Life Among the Navajo People, please do click on the link on the bottom of today's show page to go directly to her website for more information. And it truly is about being able to say, I'm starting to feel something that is so much different. How can I engage this in my life, in my health, my wellness, and even in all of my struggles? If you'd like a free complimentary session with me, please do click on the link on the bottom of today's show page, sign up for my monthly newsletter, and there is 1 week every month where I have free sessions. And you're able to ask the question, am I stuck? Am I moving forward? What's really going on? What do you see? How can we open up this can of worms? Always happy to help you and have a soft place for your words to land. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. Until tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.